This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents See You Again in Pyongyang, a journey into Kim Jong-un's North Korea. Written by Travis Jeppesen, read by Will Collier. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of bonus material. Author's note. Writing is a predatory activity. You're always stalking some amorphous ideals, often ones that cannot be named or readily summarized, in the attainment of truth and accuracy, hence the need to write. When human lives are involved, the process can become hazardous, an awareness that any writer who ventures into North Korean terrain should attain. North Korea throws into question the very nature of reality, and reminded me, again and again, the ways in which truth is constantly being remolded by its surrounding context. North Korea poses any number of daunting challenges to outside researchers. As I've been working on this book, one issue that has remained at the forefront of my thoughts is safety, less for myself and more for those I have met along the way. A compromise had to be reached in order to protect these sources. While everything in this book is truthful, in that it happened to either me or those I know well, many figures in the book are, in fact, composites of at least two or more people, and most names have been changed. Comrade Kim Nam-yeon, for instance, is a composite of men I have encountered, befriended, or otherwise learned about. Some current and others former residents of Pyongyang. And the Korean state travel company he works for is a fictional hybrid based on knowledge I have gleaned about the operations at several of the country's state-owned tourism bureaus. Among the North Korean defectors I have interviewed in the South and elsewhere, I have tried to seek out those who purposefully avoid speaking with the media. Certain defectors expect to be paid in exchange for an interview. I pointedly avoided those individuals. By being careful not to compromise people's safety, but offering no cash incentive, I tried to create an interview scenario in which my sources had no motivation to mislead me about their experiences and perspectives. In addition to the camouflaging devices outlined previously, I have employed other mechanisms from the writer's toolkit for clarity and brevity. Namely, I've shifted the order of some events and merged some conversations to improve the flow of the narrative. My intention is to present not a play-by-play accounting of my days in North Korea, but rather a representation of the range of experiences I had over multiple trips. Although the narrative primarily centers on my 2016 study program, I have, in some cases, inserted a particularly vivid experience from an earlier trip, or a subsequent visit in 2017, into the sequence of events. I also had to grapple with the issue of sourcing and fact-checking. As anyone who has studied North Korea can confirm, the standard journalistic and academic requirements of conducting research are often impossible to fulfill in this context. Fact has to be distinguished from rumor and hearsay. Ironically, this mirrors the lived experience of the average North Korean citizen, for whom most precious information is received via word of mouth. As this conflict arose again and again throughout my work on the book, I felt that the honest thing to do would be to articulate these philosophical quandaries as I recall them occurring. Some of those moments have been rendered as dialogues between myself and my travel companions. Other problems are linguistic in nature. Somewhat confusingly, there exist two systems for romanizing Korean words. A variant of the older McCune-Reischauer system is still used in North Korea, while in South Korea, a revised romanization system has been in official use since 2000. To add more confusion to the matter, most proper nouns retain the old McCune-Reischauer system in both Koreas. For example, the romanization of the common last name remains Kim, rather than the revised romanized Gim. And Pyongyang, P-Y-O-N-G-Y-A-N-G, has still not shifted to the revised Pyongyang, P-Y-E-O-N-G-Y-A-N-G. Given the predominance of this convention across most English language literature, and since it was in North Korea where I first began to learn the language, I have mostly retained the North's version of the McCune-Reischauer romanization system throughout the book, going so far as to retain the practice of dehyphenating first names, which are always written after the last name. In the South, it would be Jong-un. In the North, it's Jong-un. Despite all these challenges, I have tried to put forth only things that I know and firmly believe to be true. Any mistakes are mine and mine alone. Prologue. Obsessions lead people on strange detours, and sometimes those detours come to define the entire geography of a person's existence. Watching the fall of the Berlin Wall as a 10-year-old in the living room of a suburban house in the American South, I could not have fathomed the immense significance of what I was seeing. Sure, I had been taught that communism was something bad, the polar opposite of the pristine democracy I had been raised in and programmed to cherish. And I could understand that this evil was now coming to an end. Everything was black and white, good and bad, rough and smooth. A 10-year-old growing up in those sheltered circumstances has no real cognizance of the actual texture of things, of ways of life that differ tremendously from one's own. A little more than a decade later, I'd be walking the streets of those same gray Central European cities my childhood eyes had witnessed coming undone on the evening news. I've lived in two of those cities, Prague and Berlin, for most of my 20s and 30s. Whenever I'm asked what brought me to live in these capitals of some of the past century's darkest and most significant moments, I fail to offer a pithy reply. Something along that stretch of adolescence and early adulthood derailed me from the standard life trajectory that my southern suburban upbringing implied. A growing fascination with other ways of life led me first to New York City to study art, literature, and philosophy at a left-leaning university where nearly all subjects were viewed through the lens of a Marxist interpretation of history. I became fascinated with cultic systems of belief and their twistings of ideology, with the notion of escape, with revising my limited means of perception. The best way to do this, I discovered, was through constant movement, never staying in the same place for long, shirking any scene that might come too close to resembling the dreaded comfort zone. As my friends in Berlin, where I have been lately based, will tell you, I spend a lot of my time escaping that city for others, the notion of a static, stable place called home being increasingly nebulous. In short, I became a writer. My model, the Baudelairean flaneur Robert Walser's destinationless Spaziergänger, the wanderer whose ultimate allegiance is to no nation, no collective, and no ideology, but to the city in the broadest sense, the chaotic and confused metropolis, the crazed church of constant motion where poetic creation is born. Unlike Baudelaire, who had to stick with Paris, the possibilities of travel being what they were in the 19th century, I am fortunate to live in an era when travel is easier and cheaper than ever before. The cities of the world, in all their rich plurality, have become my extended stomping ground. Since my addiction to motion is what feeds my writing, the main purpose of travel for me is to get lost. Losing myself in the strangeness of new environs, marveling at the process each time as what is strange transforms into something familiar. I will go to great lengths, travel far distances, for the sole purpose of getting lost, of losing myself. So it is strange that someone like me would be drawn to the one city on the planet where it is forbidden to get lost. A city with strange customs that is officially governed by an even stranger ideological system. The capital of a strange country with a strange leader. A country universally demonized, laughed at, feared, and generally misunderstood. The type of place that even a traveler like me, with my perennial search for freedom from all the trappings of a conventional existence via writing and constant movement, would be likely to shrug off. No flaneurs allowed in Pyongyang. You can't even wander around on your own without the supervision of a local, government-licensed guide, whose duty it is to lead you on a strict itinerary. What could such a place possibly offer someone like me? Quite a lot, it turns out. Because the fuel for my wanderlust has perennially been a sense of intrigue, a need to gauge and decode the seemingly incomprehensible, to find the sense in the seemingly outlandish. My first novel, written when I was 23, was in part about a UFO religious cult. North Korea, from a distance, appeared like a cultish exaggeration in the present of the history I was forced to confront every day, living in two of the capitals of Europe's ill-fated experiments with communism. Over there, in North Korea, was a veritable other way of life. Like many, I didn't even know it was possible to go there. Then it happened to come up in conversation with my friend Tom Masters, a travel writer, that not only had he visited the country several times in the past, he would soon be returning to revise the North Korea chapter of a guidebook he was working on. Would I be interested in coming along? We landed in Pyongyang in the spring of 2012, just a few months after the death of Kim Jong-il. The country was suddenly in the hands of his son, about whom the people of North Korea and the world knew next to nothing. An aura of uncertainty hovered over the streets of Pyongyang, where whispered gossip and rumor form the unofficial currency. There were other currents flowing through the air, of course, the omnipresent whiffs of paranoia and suspicion. But there was also a palpable sense of hopefulness, an optimism of the potential changes that the new young leader might bring. I hadn't expected to find such a colorful place. I certainly didn't expect to be received with as much warmth as I was. Although I have spent the entirety of my adult life as an expatriate, I still hold a U.S. passport. So in the eyes of the North Korean authorities and citizens alike, I am an American through and through. In a country led by an ultra-nationalist ideology where international travel is forbidden for all but a chosen few, the notion of expatriation was and is perplexing for most North Koreans to fathom. A citizen of the enemy state. Yet none of the hostilities typically directed toward the United States by the state media of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the country's official name, DPRK for short, were ever articulated toward me by any of the North Koreans I met on that trip. I was the only American in the delegation, but was treated with as much graciousness as the others. As in other countries in East Asia, foreign visitors are considered honored guests and are treated with gratitude. Hospitality is intrinsic to the culture. A highly musical country, North Korea even has a song, Panggap Samnida, nice to meet you, which North Koreans delight in singing to all foreign visitors. Above all, North Koreans want you to not only feel welcome, but to be impressed by their country, of which they are immensely proud. I knew better than to be seduced by it all, but I couldn't help being charmed. I knew about the nukes. I knew about the concentration camps. I knew about the systematic injustices perpetrated by the regime against the populace. But is that really all there is to it? I knew going in that there would be limits to what I could find out. Somewhat perversely, not only was I able to accept the highly prescribed nature of North Korean tourism, borrowed from the former Soviet Union, but I was quickly able to comprehend the reasons why. In a country where everyone, more or less, is being watched, why should I, a tourist and a citizen of an enemy state, be exempt from this? After that initial visit in 2012, I returned to North Korea several times. The first was just a month later to see the Arirang Mass Games, which I wrote about for Art Forum. I returned again in 2014 for an architecture-themed tour that enabled me to see the extent to which the city had changed in just 2 years. That visit gave me further insight into the priorities of the country's new leadership, beyond the headlines. The ways that the capital was being transformed and reshaped according to those goals. Over the years, I devoured every book on North Korea I could get my hands on. From best-selling defectors' narratives to academic treatises focused on art, film, sociology, and the economy. Anything to gain some insight into the realities of daily life beyond the multiple layers of propaganda and myth-making. Then, in early 2016, I came upon an article on an online news site devoted to North Korea. It was about a new company, Tongil Tours. Unlike the other tourism companies offering 3 to 8 day package tours to North Korea with fairly uniform and standardized itineraries, Tongil intended to specialize in educational exchanges with the North. The brainchild of Alex Sigley, a young East Asian studies undergrad from Australia, Tongil would be offering that summer, for the first time in North Korea's history, a month-long intensive Korean language course for foreigners at one of Pyongyang's foremost educational institutions, Kim Yongjik University of Education. I immediately clicked on the link to the Tongil Tours website and applied. There wasn't a moment of hesitation on my part. I had just finished my PhD, shutting the book on a 5-year chapter of my life, and needed to lose myself in a new adventure. And there it was, spelled out in front of me. To dive into, to partake in, albeit in a very minor observer's role, this history of the present. At the same time, I've had a love of languages ever since a comparative literature professor in college instilled in me the idea that you can't properly come to understand a place until you have learned to speak the language. This, I immediately understood, was the opportunity I had long yearned for, but never thought would be possible. To come to understand the DPRK inside out, through its lingo, through an immersion, albeit limited, in daily life over an extended period of time. A chance to spend an entire month there, rather than the paltry few days of the typical tourist. Absorbing all the nuances that evade most foreigners. Some family and friends feared I might lose myself in a more literal way. Just months before, University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier had been arrested in Pyongyang for attempting to steal a propaganda banner. Some voices in the American media speculated that his detention was political and symbolic, that no American was truly safe to visit North Korea. But I had been in Pyongyang before, when other American prisoners were being held. The media fury didn't faze me. By then, I was well aware of the rules one must submit to when journeying to the DPRK, and had already debated the risks and rewards, both in my mind and in conversation with others. I had also carefully considered the ethics of traveling to North Korea. Many are against it on principle. The old torture porn argument, which views travels to such dictatorships to be a cheap exercise in the lurid exploitation of dark tourism, where all citizens one encounters should be viewed as nothing more or less than prisoners of the regime, human propaganda posters, and the possibility of providing financial aid to the development of nuclear weapons. No one has ever been able to prove that tourism funds the DPRK's military operations. Given the country's refusal to publicly disclose statistics about budgets and spending, the truth will likely never be known. Yet that doesn't stop a number of Western media outlets from asserting tourism's financial contribution to the nuclear program as though it were a fact. The North Korean government, for all the terrible things it undeniably and inexcusably does, also builds housing, schools, and hospitals for its citizens. If you had concrete proof that your tourism money was being spent on the construction of an orphanage, would this be the deciding factor that would persuade you to travel there? Are there not aspects of every country one might object to, including your own? Once we begin to impose travel boycotts on ethical grounds, we quickly run out of places we can go. The torture porn argument is harder to engage because it really comes down to the attitude and intentions of the individual traveler, which is the one thing no one can control. North Korea is an impoverished country whose people live under the ever-shifting whims of an oppressive police state. Since nearly anyone, save for South Korean passport holders, can legally visit, then it follows that anyone can go to Gok, if that is one's main intention. But the implication that this is the primary motive of everyone who goes to North Korea is ridiculous and groundless. On my earlier visits to the country, I had met people from all walks of life on my tours, from doctors to architectural historians to flight attendants, who were visiting the country for any number of reasons. Given the difficulty and expense of traveling to such a place, there is little logic that can be unearthed in the assertion that the few souls who venture there have cynical motives for doing so. Actually, the travel companies comprising the tiny market of North Korean tourism tend to emphasize the eye-opening, mind-changing vitality of one-on-one engagement between foreigners and North Koreans on these admittedly prescribed tours. And while I think it is right to be skeptical of any sales pitch, I have seen that this sort of engagement is effective. I have watched North Koreans, in conversing for the first time with an alien from the outside world, forced to alter and revise certain truisms they had been taught to believe. What's more surprising is that this process also happens in reverse. I've learned things from North Korea about the world I come from that I never would have figured out otherwise. I learned that a lot of what I had been taught to believe about North Korea is false, exaggerated, or distorted. While I always dimly perceived that all media, no matter the degree of its asserted objectivity, is ideologically biased, I've come to understand that much of the reporting on North Korea in the West, reporting that shapes our understanding of North Korea, is especially ideological. The North Korean regime and its leaders have often been described as irrational. My experiences have made me question that contention and wonder if this irrationality is more often than not a label applied by those who do not wish to understand an opponent's worldview. I believe there is a fundamental and flawed humanity that unites the people I have met there with those I have encountered elsewhere. A humanity that is often overlooked in the opportunistic pursuits of war speak and political advantage. I have seen how agency continues to creep in and operate, even thrive, under conditions of top-down repression. My interactions with North Koreans have largely taken place in approved and monitored settings. But even in such situations, there are certain things that simply cannot be controlled, and the generation of new ideas is one of them. In that sense, travel to North Korea is actually a deeply subversive activity, one that has rich benefits for both parties. It is a fruitful substitute for the more consequential forms of diplomacy that should be taking place on a higher level, but, as of this writing, are not. The month I spent in Pyongyang made me realize that despite the frequency and reach of my peregrinations across the planet's surface, my foreignness, that ingrained sense of American privilege that is so unique and difficult to shake off, had always enabled me to put a certain distance between myself and the worlds I was exploring. That I myself, as a writer, was somehow outside of everything I was observing. Outside of history, even. That writing somehow made me a ghosted presence, an invisible vehicle that might serve as a mediation filter. It is a distance, I now realize, that precludes true understanding. Getting there was the easy part. In order to really be there, to reach that point where I could begin to understand the seemingly incomprehensible, I had to dissolve that artificial distance within myself, that invisible wall that separates us from them. I took a long walk, and in the end, despite all appearances to the contrary, it was unguided. After 5 years, I ended up somewhere that looked a lot different from the place where I started off. That's the best kind of getting lost. Where in the end, you find so much more than just your way. Part 1. Dreams of a Forgotten City. Chapter 1. There's a mist that covers the entire city every morning. Waking up, it's like you haven't awoken at all, more like you are stepping from one dream into another. An enchanted otherworld. The mist doesn't blot out entirely all those vertical facades forming the cityscape. Rather, it enshrouds them, so the colorful buildings stand as actors behind a transparent stage curtain. Staring through that curtain, your eyes can just make out the cherry red flame crowning the tower of the Jusha idea, perhaps even the apex of the Ruyang Hotel. The mist curls like smoke over the Taedong River, snaking its way unhurriedly through the city center, a dredging boat or two punctuating its flow. Everything as still as these waters. You feel, at that moment, as though you are in a forgotten place, a world away from the dense mosaic of people and traffic and noise and neon signage of the 21st century capital city. In the midst of this reverie, a single tone pierces the silence. A tone so ethereal that for a moment you might believe that it is borne by the wind. Its source could be an antiquated synthesizer, a theremin. You open your window to investigate. Seems to be coming from the main train station down the road. Could it be an air raid siren? No, for then it is followed by a second note. An eerie cinematic melody coalesces from the sonic ether. It is a song. A plaintive cry. A gentle command. It is also, you realize, an alarm clock for the people of central Pyongyang. The signal that ignites the morning ritual. All around you, in the apartments of those pastel buildings, people are rising from their beds, water is splashed on faces, uniforms pressed, red pins installed on the left breast over each citizen's heart. The question posed by the song's title, "Where are you, dear general?" is answered in its resounding, omnipresent sonority, reminding all who have been roused from their dreamland, and who inevitably know its absent words by heart, exactly where they are. The capital's more ambitious denizens tend to rise even before the morning anthems blare. Over in East Pyongyang, in a formerly run-down area that has in recent years become a bastion of the nouveau riche, replete with the alluring glitz of new shops, restaurants, recreation centers, and apartment complexes, Comrade Kim Nam-young is up at 4 a.m. to the theme from Titanic, set as the alarm on his Arirang smartphone. While his wife and 8-year-old daughter sleep, Comrade Kim does his morning exercises in the living room before sitting down with a cup of tea in the kitchen to read the morning newspapers. There's the Rodong Sinmun, the workers' newspaper, the country's main news organ, but also a slew of broadsheets reserved for the eyes of business elites. There are documents that have arrived from the Workers' Party related to his position as managing director of one of the state's international tourism companies, outlining crucial policy and administrative directives that he will be obliged to carry out or at least pay lip service to. Turning back to the Rodong Sinmun, he carefully reads the daily editorial to gauge the day's tone from the government. Like most sophisticated Pyongyangites, he's become adept at reading between the lines. It is often what is glaringly absent in these rant-like missives that is most revealing. At 5:30, it is time to wake his wife and daughter. Together they sit for a shared breakfast of maize porridge and hard-boiled eggs, washed down with a sour yogurt drink imported from China, which his daughter will opt to substitute with powdered milk. Shortly after Comrade Kim departs for the office at 7, a loud knock resounds. "Get up!" shouts a familiar voice. "Time to clean!" Comrade Lee at the door, head of the Inminban, the People's Residential Unit. Every North Korean belongs to one. The units consist of anywhere between 20 and 40 dwellings. In the Kim's building, all apartments sharing the central staircase constitute one Inminban. The Inmin Banjong is usually a middle-aged or elderly woman. Her job is to heighten revolutionary vigilance, as one propaganda poster has it. Keeping a watchful eye over the comings and goings in her assigned unit, down to the smallest detail. As Comrade Lee remembers well from her training, a good Inmin Banjong knows exactly how many spoons and chopsticks are in each family's kitchen, and can spill that information on cue if the need should arise. The Inmin Banjong is, in a sense, the nosy neighbor, elevated to the status of official position. They are residential spies, required to keep track of the most intimate details of their charges' private lives. Up until 1995, Inmin Banjong were even required to report on the spending habits of citizens, especially large and luxurious items that suspiciously exceeded one's household income. Like all jobs in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the Inmin Banjong are selected. Women like Comrade Lee and their families can live quite well by local standards. In theory, they're supposed to inspect each apartment at least once a week. But in many Inmin Ban units, including the Kims, this task has been neglected over time, reflecting the ever-widening gap between theory and practice since the new young leader took over. Still, an Inmin Banjong has the capacity to make one's life a living hell. Every enterprising wife, upon moving into a new building, will go out of her way to make friends with the Inmin Banjong, flattering her with compliments and, more importantly, gifts. In return, minor blunders may be agreeably overlooked. Some duties, however, cannot be avoided. As professional busybody, the Inmin Banjong is responsible for greeting and registering each and every visitor to the property. That way, no vendors, burglars, foreigners, or counter-revolutionaries are able to make their way onto the premises. When a visitor arrives from out of town, even if it's a relative who simply wishes to stay for one night, the Inmin Banjong dutifully inspects their travel permit so as to determine exactly how many nights the traveler may stay in Pyongyang. Travel permits to the capital are notoriously difficult to obtain, though bribes can make that process go much faster. Then there are the unannounced midnight checks Inmin Banjong conduct together with the police a few times each month. Families woken up, apartments searched for illegal media and literature. The main concern is to make sure no one is sleeping on the premises without permission. Anyone caught, even if it happens to be a Pyongyang citizen who has failed to fill out the proper paperwork with the Inmin Banjong, faces interrogation, a fine, and a report filed with their own Inmin Ban and work unit. Such infractions can result in hours-long arguments with the police. Often those caught are lovers engaged in illicit affairs, and so eager to avoid having their activities widely circulated. Luckily for Comrade Kim's family and their neighbors, Comrade Lee is a rather motherly Inmin Banjong. She discreetly warns her charges when those midnight inspections are imminent, especially the elderly widow next door to the Kims, who is known to rent out her second room as an hourly love hotel for extra income. Comrade Lee is tough, however, on the morning discipline. In addition to serving as a de facto extension of the state security apparatus, the Inmin Banjong oversees the daily cleaning of the building's public spaces. It is the responsibility of one adult family member from each apartment, generally the wife, as married women, unlike men, are not required to hold day jobs in the DPRK, to spend an hour each morning on this activity. Mopping floors, trimming bushes, sweeping the sidewalk in front of the building, plucking any weeds that might have sprouted amid the landscaping. The result, as any visitor to Pyongyang immediately notices, is that the city is perpetually pristine. Pyongyang has awoken. On Comrade Kim's commute, the streets bustle with activity. Impeccably dressed white-collar workers walking steadfastly toward dimly lit offices. Red-scarved young pioneers, members of the obligatory Korean Children's Union, making their way in flocks to school. There are the drab, gray and green uniforms denoting civil servants, government officials, police, military, A motley collection of functionary traffic forging pathways through the broad avenues, the alleyways between the bright pastel buildings. At one time, nearly everyone, every man at least, was in uniform. Now restrictions have relaxed and fashion has diversified, though it's still formally conservative. Everything impeccably tailored, pressed, tidy. Still, there is some variety now. It's the middle of summer, so for men, that means short-sleeved shirts of all colors and designs, the only conforming feature, a collar. For members of the burgeoning middle to upper classes, a wristwatch is de rigueur, with the more expensive European brands like Rolex being the most sought after. Though upon closer inspection, most reveal themselves as knockoffs from neighboring China. Women's wear is more colorful and diverse. It was only in recent years, toward the end of Kim Jong-il's life, that women were permitted to wear trousers in public. Skirts still predominate and are required for many positions, always long enough to conceal the knees. But among the younger and more rebellious upper echelons, trousers or even pantsuits can be seen. Where the men have watches as their bling, women like to show off with fancy footwear. High heels combined with socks is a new look. The morning rush hour brings long lines at bus stops and crowding on the subway cars, donated by the city of Berlin, and red trams, a familiar sight to anyone who's been to Prague. They were ordered in the early 1990s from what was then Czechoslovakia. Congestion in the center each morning is managed by the robotic choreography of turquoise-uniformed traffic girls. All vehicles are government or military-owned, officially. Though the policy has become lax enough in recent years that they are often used by well-connected private citizens on business that would hardly be regarded as official elsewhere in the world. Hundreds of taxicabs, run by some half-dozen companies, compete. Comrade Kim arrives to find his office at the Korean State Travel Company glistening, as it is the duty of his underlings to arrive each morning an hour early to clean. The workday commences with a meeting. Comrade Kim's colleague reads aloud from the editorial of the Rodong Sinmun, its content breezily discussed, directives on daily tasks given. Although his organization's name is Korean State Travel Company, tourism is but one of many businesses Comrade Kim, a managing director, engages in at work each day. Since 2012, around the time that Kim Jong-un assumed power after his father's demise, the line dividing private and unofficial from state-run and official business has grown increasingly murkier. Though this obfuscation has its roots in the unofficial forms of capitalism that arose in the black markets during the famine of the 1990s. In Pyongyang, senior-level officials with good political connections and the ability to travel abroad can, in essence, do whatever they want. Comrade Kim is ambitious and enterprising. He oversees a number of import-export ventures. Food, medicine, consumer electronics, high-end cosmetics. His foreign contacts were made during the years he spent as an employee at two DPRK embassies abroad, a position that enabled him to travel to some two dozen countries. He is an emblem of what locals call the Donju, the money masters, the new rich. Different from the elites, whose privilege is handed to them at birth as a consequence of familial allegiance to the Kim family, and who still form the topmost layer of prestige, the Donju are more like second-tier elites, those who have acquired their power and wealth as a result of the accidental incursion of capitalism. The yuppies. Like other Donju, Comrade Kim carries his activities out under the auspices of a more powerful sponsor working in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, one of his old classmates from the foreign languages high school he attended. Such connections are not unlike the structure at big corporations in South Korea, where classmates go on to employ or do business with one another for life, forming guarded networks that are almost impossible for an outsider to break into. Each time a big deal goes through, Comrade Kim pays kickbacks to his sponsor, who in turn will pay a little to his own protector, all the way up to the very top of the command, the ruling family, and their associates. Whether these chains make for an alternate taxation system in a country where there is officially no income tax, or a mafia-style protection racket, is neither discussed nor talked about. It's simply how it works these days, and accounts for the increasing displays of wealth on the city's streets. It's trickle-down economics, East Asian style. The elites enrich themselves, and in doing so, create new jobs and opportunities for the classes below them. Across town, Kim Kum-hee begins her day singing and marching in single file behind her classmates into Pyongyang Primary School No. 4. Songs like Defend the Headquarters of the Revolution, which describes the Korean people as bullets and bombs, teach her that her duty as a Korean is to defend Marshal Kim Jong-un no matter what, even acting as a human shield if need be. When she learns about her country's biggest enemy, she is taught that the correct way to refer to one of its citizens is American bastard. Inside the main entrance, the students are greeted with a large painting of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il standing in front of Mount Paektu, toothy smiles plastered across the leaders' faces. Following her classmates, she bows before their likenesses on her way into the classroom. Kum-hee spends 12 to 16 hours away from her parents each school day. In George Orwell's Animal Farm, all the puppies are taken away from their mothers at birth, only to reemerge later as the warrior guard dogs that have been put into place to protect the system. Something similar happens here. In Confucian philosophy, the family is the most sacred and self-protecting unit, a highly suspect position to the North Korean state. It has to be reoriented. The state as the family. The paternal and maternal figures are wrapped up in two men, the saviors of the nation. And now the third descendant, the unblemished Paektu bloodline, the patriarchs of the state family formation. A large part of the school curriculum is devoted to the study of their lives. What they sacrificed, what they won, so that little children like Kum-hee could be the happiest in the world. She will learn that the correct way is to love them, to worship them. She will learn to accept everything she is taught without question. The questions will come later, but by then she will know better than to voice them aloud. She will instead learn to form her own conclusions. Another tone slices through the day, signaling lunch hour. There is a burgeoning restaurant scene catering to elites, though most prefer to dine out for dinner, not lunch. Some will return home to eat with their spouses. Certain offices, like Comrade Kim's, offer an on-site cantina. Over rice, kimchi, and bean paste soup, Comrade Kim chats with his colleagues. He'll be leaving work early, he tells them, along with Comrade Min. They're going to the airport. No, he's not going anywhere this time. He has to pick up a delegation. Three foreigners. All young men. They'll be studying for a month at Kim Yong-jit University of Education, an endeavor he himself set up. Such an undertaking would have been unthinkable just a couple years ago. But thanks to his standing, his connections, and the way things have been shifting around of late, the program was given the go-ahead. His colleagues chew over this thoughtfully as a couple of the men light up post-meal cigarettes. And you're not going to believe this, he smiles as they lean in for a whispered punchline. One of them is an American bastard. Chapter 2. It's the middle of July 2016, and Beijing is as humid and muggy as always this time of year, with temperatures rising to the upper 90s in Fahrenheit. Sun-baked streets swarm with slow-moving traffic. My taxi finally makes it down the car-clogged six-lane highway to the flashy shopping district of Sanlitun, its showcase shops of Western brands ringed by a concentration of trashy bars catering to tourists and expats. I'm having lunch with my friend Simon Cockerell, who runs Koryo Tours, a travel agency that organizes group excursions to North Korea. I traveled with Koryo on my first four treks there. Tomorrow, however, I'm headed back on a different kind of trip. I've enrolled in a month-long Korean language intensive at Kim Yong-ji University of Education. The university has a department offering bachelor's and master's degrees in Korean for foreigners, though currently only Chinese students are able to study there full-time. In an effort to expand its reach, not to mention its income, the university is making this first-time experiment in opening its doors to Western foreigners. It's not likely it will be viewed as a major triumph. I'm one of three students who have signed up. And another of the three is the owner of the company, Tongil Tours, a new competitor of Koryo, that arranged the trip with the North Koreans. So, technically, I'm one of two. Simon isn't surprised to hear of the low turnout. Our numbers have been flat across the board this year, he tells me. We're not losing any business, but we're certainly not gaining any. I ask him if the situation has to do with recent tensions. Not really, he says. There are always tensions. He stares into his plate of pasta, as though reconsidering that statement. If it's anything, then it's warmier. Over New Year's 2016, 21-year-old University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier traveled to North Korea for a 5-day trip with a company called Young Pioneers, named after the red-scarved socialist youth organization that all North Korean children must join. The company is known for its hard-partying tours targeting college-age students. Its motto? Providing budget travel to destinations your mother would rather you stayed away from. According to the accounts of group members, on their last night in Pyongyang, Warmbier got wasted with other tourists in the lobby bar of the Yanggakdo Hotel. Then, in the middle of the night, as the result of either a dare or drunken hubris, he snuck off into a staff-only room of the hotel and attempted to steal a propaganda banner. When he realized it was attached to a wooden partition, making it impossible to fold up and stuff in a suitcase, he simply left the banner, partition and all, on the ground, and then went back to his room. The next morning, says Simon, the staff shows up for work. What's this banner doing on the ground? It's written in Korean, which of course Warmbier can't read, so he doesn't realize that it actually has Kim Jong-il's name written on it. Of course no Korean would leave it on the floor like that. They had to go back and watch the previous night's video surveillance footage to see what had happened. By that time, it was too late. There were too many people involved. They had to report it. As his group was about to depart Pyongyang that morning, Warmbier was stopped at passport control. The police took him into custody. In the aftermath, DPRK state media presented Otto Warmbier as an undercover CIA agent on a mission. The American media asserted that Warmbier was an innocent pawn that the evil North Korean regime was attempting to use as a bargaining chip to extract more aid that it would actually use to develop its nuclear weapons program. Calls for banning U.S. tourism to North Korea resonated throughout Congress and the media. Any American, the reasoning went, could be arrested on the flimsiest of grounds. The bad press is taking its toll. We've had some cancellations, Simon admits. I wonder out loud whether Young Pioneers even bothers to brief its tour participants on the do's and don'ts of travel to North Korea, like Koryo does. If it had, then Warmbier should have been well aware that, no matter your nationality, stealing a propaganda banner would not go down well with the authorities. Meddling with a banner, after all, would result in serious, perhaps even deadly punishment for a North Korean. Why would a foreigner be considered exempt from similarly punitive measures? If anything, when traveling on an American passport to such a place, one intuits the need to be extra vigilant in respecting local laws and customs. I had heard that Warmbier originally intended to travel to Pyongyang with Koryo tours. In his televised confession after his arrest in Pyongyang, Otto asserted that he contacted both Koryo and Young Pioneer Tours, and that his father and brother considered coming along on the trip. Ultimately, Otto claimed in the confession, he decided to go with Young Pioneer Tours, because their tours are less costly. I ask Simon if this is true. Instead of answering me, He looks down at his pasta and sighs. I don't know why his father didn't go with him in the end, says Simon. I can't help but wonder if his father were with him on the trip. Would he really have been wandering around in the staff-only section of the hotel at 2 a.m. on New Year's Eve? It's true that Young Pioneers is less expensive. And it's not that Choreo is better. We're just... well, it's a different sort of culture. He stops there, with characteristic modesty. In all the years we've known each other, I've never once heard Simon say anything remotely critical or unfriendly about any of Choreo's competitors in the industry. And I have to say that Choreo does offer a more cultured version of tourism to North Korea, which is precisely why its trips are slightly more expensive. It has also been in the business much longer than its competition in this tiny niche market, has good relations with its colleagues at the state-owned travel agencies in Pyongyang, and, as the most successful company in terms of pure numbers, has been able to open doors to cities and entire regions of the DPRK that were previously off-limits to foreign tourists. While the itineraries are often similar, there is a distinction between the marketing and implicit philosophy between the two companies. Young Pioneers runs a DPRK-themed bar in the backpacker's paradise of Yangshuo in western China, where you get a free shot if you book a tour. A 2017 Associated Press article about the company's gung-ho culture reported that the founder of Young Pioneer Tours was once hospitalized in Pyongyang after breaking his ankle stepping off a moving train in a state of inebriation. Choreo, on the other hand, stresses the mutual benefits of intercultural exchange, has co-produced films, art exhibitions, and sporting events with its North Korean partners, and raised funds for orphanages in the country. He probably wouldn't have gotten shit-faced drunk and done such a stupid thing is what you're saying. Simon shrugs his shoulders. I saw the video surveillance footage. The timer clearly shows it was 2 a.m. on the 1st of January. I don't know, mate. Do you think a sober person, in the middle of the night on New Year's Eve, no less, would have done such a thing? In the lobby of my hotel, off the northern 4th Ring Road, I shake hands with Alex Sigley. We had spoken on Skype shortly after I applied to the program, but this is our first time meeting in person. The son of an Australian sinologist and Shanghainese mother, Alec is an East Asian Studies undergrad who speaks fluent Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, and has spent most of the past 5 years hopping between universities throughout the region. On his fifth visit to North Korea in 2013, his tour guide appeared one morning with her boss from the Korean State Travel Company, one Comrade Kim, who said he was eager to have an Australian business partner. He had the idea of importing the famous Australian beef. Alec told Comrade Kim politely that, while he appreciated the suggestion, he didn't want to jeopardize his entire future by violating international sanctions. Comrade Kim nodded his understanding and then suggested they team up to start a new travel company. Comrade Kim's gentlemanly demeanor left a strong impression on Alec. Along with the guide, who went by her last name, Min, he had never met such sophisticated, worldly North Koreans on any of his previous visits. Both had spent a lot of time outside the country and had a good understanding of the world Alec came from. They were able to speak a common language. What's more, Pyongyang Project, the educational endeavor that Alec was traveling with, was falling apart. He and Comrade Kim both knew it. Kim suggested that Alec pick up where Pyongyang Project left off. A student-run initiative offering educational tours to the DPRK. Tongil Tours, named after the famous Tongil Reunification Street in Pyongyang, was born. It's attributable to Kim's worldliness and internal contacts in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of Education that this study trip was able to happen. Many other organizations had attempted similar initiatives with the DPRK in the past, but none had come to fruition. Until now. Alec, who already speaks Korean to a relatively advanced degree, has to come along to see and experience it for himself. Since only a French graduate student and I have signed up, Tongil Tours is losing money on the trip. But in this case, Alec doesn't mind. Quiet and serious, He has the determination of someone who is led by his passions. He might be operating at a financial loss, but he is also breaking new ground. He takes the idea of engagement one step further than Koryo. We're at three different levels of Korean, Alec tells me as we wait in the lobby for our third party to show. You're a total beginner, and I think Alexander, the French guy, has studied for a year or so. I told them that we will need three different teachers, so we'll see. I think there shouldn't be any problems, though. I have a good relationship with our partners in Pyongyang. We're friends. Our classes are to be held Monday through Friday, 2 hours each morning, at Kim Yong-jik University of Education in East Pyongyang. Named after Kim Il-sung's father, who was himself a teacher, the university is the country's most prestigious training ground for future pedagogues, and is also home to a Korean linguistics department. Afternoons and weekends will be devoted to homework and excursions. Here comes Alexander. Alec nods toward the door. Outside, a tall, strapping figure hurriedly removes his luggage from the trunk of a taxi and ambles his way through the rain into the hotel lobby. Like me, Alec has only previously met Alexander through Skype. They instantly recognize each other. "Guys," says Alexander, using the unlikely American vernacular as he takes turns shaking our hands. "Great to meet you both." He has the gregarious confidence of someone twice his 21 years. Someone who has clearly seen much of the world. Whereas Alec, with a slight hunch he attributes to an adolescence spent playing computer games, holds himself with a certain amount of reserve and shyness, though he can also cut loose and be quite funny when opening up about his secret non-intellectual passions, like death metal, geeking out about his love of the North Korean girl group, the Moranbong Band, and revealing himself to be a secret stoner. Alexander radiates a jovial openness so unlike the common stereotype of impossible complexity foreigners often hold of the French. His exuberance is underlined by his stocky, solid build and handsome face. He's also a travel addict, has a deep-sea diving license, and studied abroad in Dubai before gaining his recent place at the Sciences Po in Paris. I realize I'm at least 12 years older than the others, but it's fine. We go for beers and barbecue across the street. "Guys, just to let you know," Alexander says, suddenly turning serious, "I won't be drinking on this trip. As a rule, I do not drink when I go there. I'm very sorry, it's just..." "You're afraid something might slip out?" I venture. "I know myself," Alexander smiles self-consciously. And he knows the DPRK. He's been there 4 times before, the same number as me. Alec has us dwarfed at 10 prior visits. Though probably none of us will ever manage to top Simon, who's visited on a record 150 occasions. This is how DPRK obsessives get to know each other. Where you've been, what you've done. What you still haven't seen, but would like to. It's this latter piece we get stuck on. Alec has sent us a proposed itinerary composed largely of excursions all three of us have already seen and done. Any wiggle room? Alec assures us it can all be adjusted tomorrow on the ground, with Kim and Min. We head back to our rooms across the street, agreeing to meet in the lobby at 9 the next morning and share a taxi to the airport. Chapter 3. Pyongyang, as one of the city's first foreign explorers described it in 1894, has a truly beautiful situation on the right or north bank of the clear, bright Taedong, 400 yards wide at the ferry. It occupies an undulating plateau, and its wall, parallel for 2.5 miles, rises at the stately water gate from the river level, and following its wingdings, mounts escarped hills to a height of over 400 feet, turning westwards at the crest of the cliff at a sharp angle marked by a pavilion, one of several, and follows the western ridge of the plateau, where it falls steeply down to a fertile, rolling plain. Throughout history, Pyongyang has gone by as many different names as it has identities. The city has been cursed with a cyclical history of war, defeat, and rebirth. It was once known as the Capital of Willows, but owing to the ravages of constant battle and rapid industrialization, there are far fewer willow trees around today. The name Pyongyang means flatland, an apt description for the landscape surrounding